This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
They say most of your brain shuts down in cryosleep, all but the animal side. Guess that's why I'm still awake.
Welcome everybody to Cinematic Animalia, your weekly foray into the biology of movie monsters. Today, we are looking at the launching pad of the mountainous monotone, the deadpan despero, the unintelligible underdog, the round mound of pound himself, Vin Diesel, in Pitch Black.
Hand shark!
We'll go over some news first, tell you a bit about the movie, our thoughts, and then get stuck into the science that this movie brings up, including social animals, the mechanics of flight and echolocation, followed by a dive into what makes an anti-hero or anti-hero. As always, this show will be broken up into those different segments, so you can skip ahead to whatever piques your interest today. Before we get started, my name's Sam Perrin. I'm an invasive ecologist and climate data analyst based in Trondheim, Norway. I also run the website Ecology for the Masses alongside Adam Harsick, a disease ecologist at the Ben Negev University of the Gurion. Alongside Adam is, now you're going to guess who I'm doing here, the Baroness, Her Ladyship Libby Young, our story specialist and writer at Short Story Soup.
Is it Vin Diesel?
No.
Is it Mr. Bean if I hit him over the head with a saucepan 2 minutes before he had to perform?
Who's the prince with the really big ears? Elizabeth's son.
Oh, Charles. Yeah.
I think Charles. Is it Prince Charles?
No. I'm doing an impression of Dave doing an impression of an English person.
There we go. Got me.
Speak of the devil, we are joined by Dave, as always, a vet and our movie physiologist.
Also, speaking of Dave, listeners, if every single cut this week isn't Vin Diesel yelling hand shark, it's because Dave didn't let me.
Or round mound of pound. We can, yeah. Can we allow the round mound of pound?
I'll allow it.
Who's got news?
I have two gorilla related newses.
Speaking of Vin Diesel,
a brand new baby lowland gorilla was born in the DRC in one of the protected parks there, making the troop size officially 7. It's a very critically endangered species, so that is a very good boon to the population.
Mm-hmm.
It really is.
Depressing when one individual being born is considered a boon.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, it was like a huge bonus to me, because when Libby first showed the news with us on our group chat, she said, the population's at 7. I was like, oh no. It's like, well, that's just one troop. I said, okay, good.
Yeah.
But then I told you the real numbers, and I was like, oh no.
And then I was like, medium, okay.
Yeah. There's only 9 in this troop, but there's 17 in the wild. It's fine.
Yeah, exactly.
That's almost twice as many.
Yeah.
So the other gorilla-related news is I read, and someone can correct me if I'm wrong, because I did not research this. I just read a quick article that my friend sent me. So I read that they took a bit of Harambe's sperm when he was tragically killed, and so now he is able to live on through his son or daughter.
They did, and they can.
And make a Harambebe.
Aww.
Harambebe. All I gotta say is digs out for Harambe.
Yeah. You said killed, Libby. Murdered is the correct term. Murdered.
Yes, murdered. Yeah.
My name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die!
No!
All right. We did Pitch Black this week. So, what happens when a drug addicted bounty hunter, a pilot, a preacher, 2 prospectors, a wealthy merchant, 4 kids, and a notoriously violent criminal walk into a bar? They hop on the next interplanetary flight together. Of course, not a bad joke, but the plot for our movie. Next, our flying clown car crash lands on a planet, and just in time for a 22-year eclipse event in which the planet goes dark and everything with a pulse becomes part of a fun dining-in-the-dark experience from carnivorous underground flying aliens. As it should be, half of the children are eaten first, but the man with the shiny eyeballs and the heart of gold tries to save the rest. Well, technically he tries to leave everyone for dead, but our plucky captain is morally guided by him to realize that she wants to save everyone. So really, he's the hero, not her, right? Right.
Yeah.
Also, these are not aliens, Libby. They're on their home planet. And
theoretically.
The humans are the aliens here, I think you'll find.
What are we looking at here?
We're looking at Boomer. This is Boomer. He's got the biggest mouth of them all. He's the whale shark.
Okay. Dave, you want to go first? You never go first. What did you like about this movie?
I did feel like this was, when I first watched it as a younger guy, this was the first attempt at an anti-hero that I'd actually seen, where it wasn't some bullshit of like they're secretly lovable or they've got like a big thing. Like, he straight up tries to leave everyone at the end of the movie. If it has not been for the captain who comes in and is like, please, please, please don't do this, he would have been long gone.
I think for me, this is a movie, like I said last week, that I had never seen in its totality until two nights ago when I watched it with Libby. And I really enjoyed it. This is that perfect, like, comfort food, late 90s, early 2000s, dumb monster movie with Vin Diesel just Vin Dieseling so hard. You've never seen a Diesel any harder than this Diesel did. I think it was also really interesting just seeing a movie. I think this is the first movie I've actually seen that not only showed a kid's death, but a kid's dismembered body after the fucking monsters get at it. I was really surprised, first off, that the kid died, and second, they showed his body.
There's actually a law, I think, that they passed. I don't know when, but I'm pretty sure it's probably after this movie, where you actually can't show violence against children anymore, like, on screen.
Really?
So it's a law? I thought it was just, like, one of those unwritten rules.
No, okay. They passed some sort of law where it's like, you can't show it.
It's called the Diesel Declaration.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I have seen this movie more times than I can count. I remember absolutely loving it when I was a young lass. I have to say the eye effect, I know their context, but they still look dope as fuck.
It looks so cool.
yeah, it looks so cool. And I know that even though, like, when you say, like, all the plot kind of out loud, it sounds ridiculous, but I also completely buy this world. I feel like there's something I personally call, like, the Star Trek effect. So, like, basically, when movies are made in a certain time period that are made about the future, they are limited to sort of like what that thinking of the future is. So, like, for example, with Star Trek, like, it's space and, you know, space travel, but like, it's the fucking 50s in space, you know, like, it's not really very futuristic. And it makes sense, you know, because there's like concepts that we're just not, we can't, you know, conceptualize. So this is very much 2000s in the future, but I still love it. Like, I love that, you know, world. You know, so for example, like when they say that in the end where they're like, just tell him that Riddick died on the planet. And when I was watching this, I turned to Adam and I was like, so the future doesn't have like face or DNA technology to recognize people. Like, he can just like pretend he died. But I don't care. Like, it's just really fun to me, so.
For me, it's fucking weird unironically liking Vin Diesel in a movie for me. I don't know what it is. It feels very strange. There were some... There were some hilarious moments in this as well. Like, when he says, you told me it was clear. No, I said, it looks clear. What does it look like now?
looks clear.
And then they have to triage patients all the time in the field. Really? They kept calling it murder when I did it. Like, I love those lines. I thought they were fantastic. And obviously, I really loved hearing all the Aussie accents just flying thick and fast. It was weird that Radha Mitchell, who was Australian as well, had an American accent for most of the movie. I say most of the movie because there are a couple of scenes where she is just full on Aussie.
Yeah.
Yeah, I heard that too.
I love that line of Riddick beating the Bioraptor to death. Did not know who he was fucking with.
Yeah.
I think my favorite is when he's trying to have his deep emotional moment with the captain at the end, and she's like struggling. He's like, shut up! It's like in her face. He's like, I'm trying to tell you how good you are.
Yeah. I love that line of, I said I'd die for them, not for you. And then she, that was like, I genuinely felt bad at that point. I was like, fuck, that's a good death. As in, I mean, she died a fucking horrible death, but it's a good death scene in a movie. I thought it was really good.
She really did.
Yeah.
I thought I said no shivs. You mean this? It's just a personal grooming application for appliance.
Tool. Yeah.
That shit he had on his head, that was gross. The motor oil. Yeah. Oh, oil, yeah. God.
Grease.
Yeah. It was like dyed KY jelly.
Yeah.
I've got something here with such fantastic detail, it's going to blow you away.
Okay, what didn't we like about this movie?
I mean, there is not a huge amount that I hate about this film. I really enjoyed the first Riddick. I thought it was good. It was funny. It feels very small in terms of, again, there's no big world-changing event. We'll get into my concerns with the creatures later on, but I still just love this film.
I think for me, it's a thing that's not really its fault, where it's more a product of its time. This horrendous orange then blue color palette, the weird camera angles, and going
where they like
to
stretch
the
camera.
They stretch the camera. They flip the frame like 100. they mirror it like 3 times in a second for some reason during the crash. During a dramatic moment, they pan to 4 different characters and also flip it to the negative for some reason.
This won a cinematography award in Australia.
Really?
Yeah.
How?
The Australian Cinematography Society. I mean, it was the 2000s. The Australian film industry wasn't exactly booming. If you had a fucking major motion picture, they're just like, well,
here's one for
this
you.
This is great.
It's this and the feature-length episode of McLeod's Daughters you've got to choose from. So,
yeah. So I think beyond those, the only thing that really bothered me was Keith David's character, Imam. It's just, I feel like attempt by white writers to use what they thought was an exotic sounding name for this Muslim character when they just called him the Muslim equivalent of priest.
Yeah, I thought he was an imam. I thought people were calling him imam because
that's his name.
What he was. That's his name. Oh, wow.
Saying that's his name.
Okay, right. I did not know that. I thought
Keith,
he was just
Keith David
an
was
imam.
Wonderful. I loved him because he's Keith David, of course.
Yeah.
And that's the second fun movie we've seen with him, that we've done with him in the podcast, actually, of the whole group getting picked off one by one and him somehow making it.
But on that note, I'll chime in because, you know, mine has a lot to do with Adam's. Those three Muslim kids, I have never seen characters that had disposable written over them so plainly.
Yup.
Like, yeah. They didn't even have a fucking line. Like, did any of them have a line that was in English? I don't think so.
I think one of them might have said one thing in English, but I will counter that, Sam, with the most disposable characters I've ever seen is literally every Witcher in the Witcher series season 2.
Oh, okay. Yeah, fair enough.
Look at all these people we never introduced that are just filling this room for some reason.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, I just didn't think there was anything amazing about this. Like, it was a completely, like you guys said, it is a completely passable Saturday night at home filler, but I wasn't particularly engaged at any point. Okay. And I did find myself checking the time every now and then.
Yeah, I think for me, I'm genuinely not trying to harp on feminism every single episode, but the unnecessary sexual predation marketed like it's supposed to be sexy is so cringy every time. So the scene in the ship in particular, where he keeps like imposing himself over her shoulder, like just like moving and then moving to the other shoulder, like, ugh. It was just too creepy. And
is that supposed to be sexy, though?
Yes, that's absolutely
that's what
you're
going
sexy.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he cuts
like
a
he's
piece
dangerous and
sniff.
Edgy. Yeah, and it's like hot because he's so dangerous.
It's worse in Riddick, though. I feel it's much worse in Riddick.
As I told you guys last week, like my favorite line in Chronicles of Riddick, it's in one of the opening scenes, and he comes up to the female character and he fucking sniffs her and it says, "It's been a long time since I've smelled beautiful." Like, I just pictured the dude writing that thinking he like cracked cum on lines. So he's like, oh man, this is
You mean Vin Diesel? Because Vin
Yeah,
Diesel
that sounds exactly
that.
Like something Vin Diesel would say in real life, yeah.
I have to say too, I side with Sam a little bit. I still love this movie, but I think it's pretty formulaic. The ending, I absolutely hate. It's just like so pointless. Like, cool, you killed 10 of the thousands of creatures on this planet. And then I actually found a review from Roger Ebert that I really liked. Pretty concise. He says, "How sad is it that humans traveled countless light years away from Earth only to find themselves inhabiting the same tired generic conventions?"
Head shark!
Okay, so first bit of trivia. For anybody who didn't know, Vin Diesel, right? And this is Sam's dumb trivia of the week, number one, is when I watched this film in like 2006, 2007, it was the first time I realized that Vin Diesel was his actual name and not the character from the Fast and the Furious. because it's a fucking franchise about cars, right? So I assumed that Vin Diesel was the character's name. And then I watched Pitch Black and they were like, it's Vin Diesel. I was like, that,
that's a character's
is it a crossover?
He challenges the monsters to races.
Exactly, yeah.
I live my life quarter mile at a time in the dark.
Yeah. But then, yeah, his real name is Mark Sinclair, which is just, I mean, it's not like a bad name.
It's not Vin Diesel, though.
No, it's not Vin Diesel. Yeah.
I also don't think that's his real voice, from my understanding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an affected voice.
From my understanding, he's got a bit of a high, reedy voice in real life.
Who's got proper trivia?
So the full-size spaceship stage they used in the movie can actually still be found in the Australian outback mining town where it was partially filmed. Is it called
Cooper Petey?
Oh, cool. Cooper.
It is Cooper Petey!
It's Cooper Petey?
Uh-huh. It was bought by a local businessman soon after filming, and so it just sits out in the open. And also the same desert scenes in that location were also used in Mad Max Beyond the Thunderdome.
Cool.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Cooper Petey is one of the only places in Australia where they have like dugout houses under the ground because it's so fucking hot there all the time.
Oh.
Yeah, I feel like I listened to way too many Aussie podcasts because I know that town and I know that it was going to be my guess if I had to guess what mining town it was going to be from.
From my understanding, they actually filmed in like the winter season, so it was like low 50s, and so they actually had to spray the actors with mist to make it look like they were sweating.
Low 50s? Oh, Fahrenheit.
Yeah, sorry.
What's low 50s in Celsius?
In the, like, 10.
10, okay.
He sends a competition to a watery grave. Boom!
I love the idea that there is no name that's ever used for the creatures that they encounter on the planet, but the fan base collectively just ended up dubbing them Bioraptor, which is a fantastic name, and one of the rare situations where I'm like, cool, the fans actually came up with something I love.
But why is that good? I don't, because bio stands for biological.
I don't either.
Yeah, like biological raptor. What are other raptors? Mechanic? Are you part of this like
animatronic?
I think it sounds cool.
Are you part of this fucking birds aren't real cult, Dave?
Oh God,
it's a fake cult. It's a fake conspiracy theory meant to take the piss out of other conspiracy theories.
Have you seen the video of the founder of that movement doing an interview when he like chokes on tea?
No. I didn't realize it had a founder. I thought it was just an internet meme that sprang up.
He's like having a talk with two like newscasters, and he goes to take a drink of like some tea while he's talking. He just goes like spits it all over the fucking place, and he's like, "I'm sorry." And they cut open and cut away at meal.
Birds aren't real. Founder throws up in live viral TV interview. Oh my God!
Can you post this?
So funny.
Can you post this?
It's so goddamn funny.
Say hello to that round mound of pound.
Vin Diesel is apparently able to rotate his arms all the way around to make the escape that he's capable of doing in the film, but has reported that the scene was accomplished with CGI since the way that the cuffs were crafted was too difficult for the stunt to occur, which just sounds like a typical Vin Diesel thing, being like, oh, I could totally do that, but just the cuffs, they were too tight, guys.
It's not me.
So, like,
yeah.
So I was too buff.
Sorry, the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission had to issue a tweet saying birds are real.
Yeah. Of course they did.
Riddick was supposed to die in the end, so Vin Diesel and the crew were actually pretty intrigued by him as a character, so they rewrote the ending for open-endedness.
Do we know if his name is actually Richard B. Riddick, or did he just make that shit up?
I bet B stands for bitched. Richard Bitched Riddick.
The film was originally titled Nightfall, and it was all about a female outlaw named Tara Krieg, with tribal tattoos and enhancements from her interstellar tribe of barbarians.
Ooh.
I don't.
Why make a woman about a badass? Why make a movie about a badass woman when you can change it and make it about a badass white male?
Yeah.
I mean, at least he didn't have tribal tattoos.
Yeah, that's the thing. If you make it like tribal tattoos, I mean, Australian indigenous populations, I don't think are big on the tribal tattoos. That's in New Zealand. But still, if you put it in that part of the world and you're like, these people are savages, look at their tribal tattoos, then...
Yeah.
Yikes.
Not a good look.
Yeah.
All right, the last bit of trivia I had, which I thought was kind of stupid but fun, the contact lenses that he wore for the movie, LensQuest actually made a limited release called Shine Job, and completely botched that. The contact lenses Vin Diesel wore in the movie, though they were a prototype for the production, LensQuest actually made them for the release of the film and released them to the general public, and they called them the Shine Job.
I think also it's worth mentioning for the, it's just called Riddick, the third installment in the series. Vin Diesel basically had to like leverage all of his money, including, I think he actually put his house up as collateral to like fund that movie to make it work. And if it hadn't worked, he would like have nothing left.
Wow.
I like that one. I actually really enjoyed that movie.
Yeah, but like, where has all his money gone in 2013?
I think this is before the Fast and Furious movies picked back up, so it's probably wasn't too much left, if I had to guess.
Rocky Balboa action!
So, before we start looking at the science today, if you've got any thoughts or questions, you can find Adam and I on Twitter. I am at Big Dr. Fishboy. Adam is at Harsic Adam. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can visit our website, cinematicaanimalia.com, or email us at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. If you want to read Libby's work, visit shortstorysoup.substack.com, and you can sign up for fortnightly emails with new stories. And if you want to hear about the less movie-related ecology that Adam and I and a huge team of international writers write about on a weekly basis, you can check out ecologyforthemasses.com. And as always, if you're listening, give us an in-rating app.
In-app rating?
Everybody, I just want you to know that Libby's watching the Birds Aren't Real interview, and she's crying.
I watched it like 5 times.
It just gets better every time. It
does. And as always, if you're listening, give us an in-app rating and let us know what you enjoy about the podcast and which movies you would like us to do next, because we're always on the lookout for fan suggestions.
All right, now that we're getting into the beef of this movie, I had to channel my inner Vin Diesel and take off my jacket and show off my big beefy arms.
Yeah, you got to roll them sleeves up a little more, Adam.
There we go. Just put these up.
Okay,
another
fire. We didn't have too much on the ecology side this week because we don't have a lot to go on. We don't really see an ecosystem per se. But it is a toss-up as to whether these creatures are social or not, because they are all roosting together. But they are crazy aggressive towards each other. Yeah, they doesn't
seem to... We assume they're roosting together. They don't... Although they're in this like communal hive situation, they all come out at the same time. I don't know if that would qualify as like a social, not social, but like roosting together. Because you see, like we talked about it before the podcast, some bat species are social and they do actually roost next to one another, like in close contact.
Yeah.
But except for that mound, we see the our female lead. So I cannot remember her name right now.
It's Carolyn.
That we see Carolyn go into, and we see the monsters like running around the ceiling a little bit. They don't really seem to be together. They might also be sharing a space they can survive in because it's out of the light. And the smaller ones that come rushing out of the well, we also don't see them roosting together. They just happen to all be activated at the same time.
The small ones that come out of the well display coordinated flight patterns. So I think they have to be social in some sense. But the large ones, I think that area that Carolyn is walking around in, where we first encountered them in the background, I think that's just like the outer limits of a bigger cave system that they all sprout out of later. Yeah. But now, I mean, if they are social,
it would have to be.
Yeah, there's some very like aggressive behavior towards each other that kind of contradicts that sort of thing. Because I don't know that there would be any kind of hierarchy here when you've got groups that are that massive. So I think we've got two options. One is that they are social, but there's such a lack of food at this point that they're getting extremely aggressive and defensive and just kind of churning on each other. If they're waking from kind of a hibernation event, for want of a better word, and we'll talk about this a little bit later on, they might need food instantly. They might just be super aggressive, and there's just not as much food around as they're used to. Or option two, we've just got a case of kind of population density dependence. So density dependence is when you get a population that becomes way too dense, and all of a sudden there's just not enough food to go around because they've done so well in previous seasons or previous years that the population's just grown too high, and the food is no longer enough to support them, at which case you generally get a pretty severe population crash. So that might just be what we're having here. Like, you have a population whereby normally there would be enough food to go around, and you see all those massive, like, megafauna-looking skeletons in that graveyard nearby. But at this point, there's just not enough food to go around, and the population's too large, so they are getting ravenous and turning on each other rather than starving to death.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a possibility, but you also seem to have a age-structured, like, social grouping. So the younger ones are a lot smaller, and they seem to be attacking and flying in a group. Like Sam mentioned, they have coordinated flight. So that's something you see with organisms that are adapted to move and act as one larger organism to confuse would-be predators. And the larger ones, they don't really do the same thing. They fly in a group, but they just happen to be doing the same thing at the same time. They're not exhibiting that same kind of that clustered and coordinated flight behavior that the smaller ones do. So I think that these smaller ones stay together like that to avoid predation by the larger ones. And the larger ones, although they are killing each other, we don't really see them doing too much consuming.
But do we know that they're the same species?
They seem to be.
Do they? Because I thought they looked quite different. I had always assumed that they were just different species.
They're reported in the literature to be the same species. They've said that they're like the babies. But I would agree with you guys. I feel like it makes more sense if they're different.
It would, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, for sure. And I do actually think that both populations are much larger. Because, I mean, as we've said before, if you've got a species that can fly and a species that's quite large, then their distribution range is going to be quite large. So I think that like Libby said, you know, we see like tons of these creatures when they first emerge. And I think a lot of those creatures would have just gone further off. Whereas we only saw a small part of the population that dropped down onto the easy prey that was nearby. I think that if, you know, potentially these things do hunt in larger social groups, but we just didn't see that because, I mean, you don't need.
There also might be a lot more variation than what we're capable of seeing in the film. This might be like a person like me looking and being like, that's a fish. All fish are fish. And Sam's like, no, there's this and this and this and this. And I'm like, the little fish grow into big fish, right? And you're like, no, they just.
It feels like a bit like, you know, you're seeing a kiwi walk along the ground and then an emu comes by later and you're like, oh, that's a baby of the tall one.
Right.
We don't know because we never get a clear look at those first ones.
Yeah.
Of the tiny ones that come out. Yeah. But regardless, I think these things actually have a massive distribution. Like, and this is probably just a small kind of outcropping. This might even be kind of like an island situation where you have much larger cave systems in other parts of the continent that they're on. But we're just seeing like a really small population here.
Right. And that is a bit of a problem that they show up in this one area. The ship crash lands in a desert. And their first reaction is, well, the entire planet must be desert.
Oh,
it must be all desert. And it's like, you have no idea. And they're like, everything's been wiped out here. And like, these creatures must be all over this planet. Like, you've landed in one tiny little area that you can't stray that far from because you don't have water. You have no idea what's on this planet.
Yeah. It's very strange. Because, I mean, we see this in Star Wars all the time. We've talked about this before. They define that they have swamp planets and desert planets and all that sort of shit. But this is just a person, arriving there and thinking, oh, these bioraptors have killed every living thing on this planet.
Yeah.
It's a very strange assumption.
If you landed in a human desert and looked around, you'd be like, oh, this planet is empty. There's nothing here.
Yeah.
Can confirm.
Dropping into the middle of the Sahara and thinking, well, no water here.
Yeah, whole world must look like this.
And his power slam, very deadly.
But speaking of dispersal by flight.
Yeah, so.
Segways, baby.
Circling back to our bioraptors themselves. I know you guys hate the name. I still like it.
Don't hate it. It's just stupid.
I hate it.
They're cool
looking.
I don't
hate it. It's just dumb. I just think it's dumb, you know?
They have wings coming out of their back capable of flight. They don't appear to have any pelvic limbs. They just have a big tail that curls around them and has the tip sort of attached to it. When cut, their blood is sort of the thick and blue color. They've got the sort of large hands that they have the bone spears that can come out of, where they kind of stick that out and they get the protrusions that launch from them. And then they've got those huge, oddly shaped head without any eyes, with sort of an implication they're using echolocation for everything that they're doing.
I thought they had eyes at the end of the...
No, so it's just like stalked bone at the end of it. There's no eyeball there. And we get to see their vision a couple of times in the film, and we'll get a bit into that and kind of why that's cool.
How can you see anything with that vision?
Yeah, well, we're going to talk about why this goes downhill a little bit. But flight. So flight typically associated, at least on Earth, with smaller animals. We don't tend to think about flight with like our really giant birds because gravity is a factor and gravity is always there. But there are some very large animals that have existed in our history that we think are capable of flight. So we talk about animals like the magnificent Argentine bird that was potentially the largest bird capable of flight, having a wingspan of 7 meters and weighing around 70 to 80 kilograms, they think.
Jesus.
Yeah. The largest living wingspan is possessed by the wandering albatross that has a wingspan of somewhere between 2.5 to 3.5 meters. And the heaviest living flighted bird is the Cory buster. So it is found in southern Africa, and it is the heaviest living flying creature with an average
and they're
male.
Terrifying.
Are they?
Yes. The locals actually call them Cory bastards. That's a true story.
Cool.
They're not great flyers, though, are they?
No, they are not. The average male weighs in between 10.9 to 16 kilograms. However, there have been specimens that have been found to weigh up to 40 kilograms. They have an average wingspan of 2.3 to 2.7 meters.
I love this bird. It looks like an emu and an ostrich had a love baby, and that baby just hates everyone. It just looks like a prick at the bar and wants to pick a fight with everybody.
They're mean little bastards.
Okay.
Although now I'm picturing this 41... like just sitting and watching all his friends fly off and being really sad.
There have been some discussions on how larger flighted animals, like the Quetzalcoatlus, could potentially have flown. And there's still a lot of split research. The newest paper that actually Sam ended up sharing with me, having a discussion of the belief that these animals would have actually had to leap into the air. So using strong rear legs to jump twice its hip height and then beginning to flap the wings as soon as it had accomplished ground clearance. So theoretically...
Yeah, they described it as like punching off from the ground.
And we do see this with some bird species that are currently still alive. So herons and egrets. This is the same method that they use to basically push themselves into the air to take off. If you've ever watched it, it's really beautiful. With our bioraptors in the film, I don't think they're very heavy. So when they're flying in and they go to hit Vin Diesel, Vin Diesel catches one of these in his hands and he's able to actually hold it in the air at arm's distance, keeping this thing away from biting him. I don't actually have a lot of problems with these guys flying other than they just have shitty wings. Their wings are not large enough for what they would need to accomplish. And it is odd for them to have wings and arms, as we've sort of talked about before, unless this is a modified structure where they just have very digitized feet and we're just not getting a great viewpoint of how they like take off and fly. They would need to have larger wings, but I have no problems with them being lighter than they look with a pneumatized bone structure and probably a lot more fragile than we think, similar to modern day birds, which would explain how he is able to fairly easily kill one of these. That being said, I mean, if it bites you, I mean, if an emu bites me, it's still going to kick my ass at the end of the day. Something big biting you and tearing at you or tearing at you in numbers. Yeah, John's died badly.
Yeah, and we see those teeth. They are fucking, that's a big row of very sharp teeth. Yeah.
Would you mind explaining to a non-scientist the difference between hollow bones and pneumatized bones?
Basically the same thing. But the pneumatized bone structure just has to do with carrying a larger degree of air, which is actually really important for birds as well, because on top of having extra enhancements to their lungs in terms of how they're able to get oxygen in, they also can store O2 within their bone structure, if memory serves. Now, the biggest thing that I also have serious problems with, I have no idea what the fuck is going on with their head for flight. The rest of the body kind of has an aerodynamic.
It can't.
It's just, they're completely top heavy. They're carrying around this giant chunk of bone stuck to their head. And their tail as well, the way that it curls underneath them, maybe if it splays out while they're flying, they can use it like a rudder to help them basically like fly through the air, similar to how a plane adjusts with control of the tail. But these creatures wouldn't, you can't fly with a head like that. It's not aerodynamic. It's just going to drag. And if they turn that thing even a little bit while they're flying, they are just going to fuck off their flight pattern.
I was going to say, it's going to be really bad for in cave systems as well. Like, if you've got this big fucking thing jutting out from side to side and you're trying to move around in, like, a tight cave system, it's going to be, like, the worst possible thing for you.
Yeah,
the crest on the head, like, there's a lot of flying creatures that had that sort of thing as, like, their sexual selection. Like, sorry, there's not a lot now, but there have been a lot of pterosaur skeletons that they've recovered that have a similar sort of crest, that sort of thing. But it's way smaller than what we see on these things.
Basically, with all the people here in the village that Libby and I live in, are Nubian ibex, which are basically more exotic goats that have enormous horns that curve out of their head and go back towards their back. And the males are, you know, pretty large, you know, goat-like animals, but their horns are still smaller than in an individual one of these face crests that these bioraptors have. And those can weigh up to 15 kilograms. So these things on this bioraptor would probably weigh 20 to 30 kilograms each, and there's four of them, so...
Yeah, hang on. I'm sending you an article of... Pterosaur had a head crest so tall it may have made it hard to fly.
Oh.
That poor thing. It's so cute.
Yeah.
It looks like Toucan Sam's Bizarro.
Yeah, it looks like the toucan beak is sticking up out of its head at a 90-degree angle.
It's also just going to fuck up all properties of lift. If anyone who's ever been driving down the highway before and you've had your hand out the window just like catching the breeze and you've just altered your hand shape in any slight way and you felt like your arm bounced down towards the car or anything like that, this thing flies along and it just twists its head a little bit to look at Vin Diesel and it just eats shit.
Plunges into the ground. Just 90 degrees straight down.
Aside from that, I mean, I don't have any problems with them being lighter than they look and flying. They just need larger wings, smaller head, and their tail needs to actually be doing something.
Sledge the Hammerhead loves to floor the competition with the flying headbutt.
Now, another cool part of the physiology to get into, and something we've talked about before, these things obviously hate the light. More than a 42-year-old gamer who still lives at home in his mother's basement.
I feel attacked.
You don't need to bring Adam and I into this, Dave.
Not even 40 yet. Jesus.
Now, in terms of when light hits these things, we see that the skin basically starts to boil and break apart, which is the explanation that's given as to why these things don't just simply raid the planet the minute the spaceship hits and eat everybody who's present there. There are natural examples of reactivity that takes place in nature. Solar urticaria.
Yeah, watch the documentary Blade.
Or Troll Hunter.
Yeah.
With solar urticaria, it's a sun allergy. Humans basically form hives that start to break out. They get itchy and red within minutes of sun exposure. It can last for a short time or up to hours. We know that it's just a triggered something called histamine release. It's just an allergy that basically takes place. It is genetic and it can be passed over from generation to generation. There are a number of different what we call phototoxins or photoirritants. That basically material that is chemically induced in skin irritation that basically can irritate and make photosensitivity. It can make your skin feel worse. And there are compounds, there are drugs that we talk about, things like that, that can weaken natural immunities to sunlight. And then there's also just sunburns. All right. Long-term exposure to UV radiation will trigger sunburns to form. That's why we've got a number of different protective mechanisms that exist in our skin. Could these guys be in a situation where sunlight would make them like burn and boil? Yeah, 100%. I just have no mechanism for why you would want this throughout this entire population that lives in the desert.
In a place with three suns.
Maybe some kind of bottlenecks in their past where you have a more diverse population that had a better gene pool. Something kills them off, and for whatever reasons, the ones that survive are the ones that have this sun allergy, and they're the ones who propagate and reproduce. And like Dave said, it's heritable, so every offspring from there on out has it, so the entire population is what has it.
Yeah. How would that work with artificial light, though? Because in the scene that they do it, they show the
it would not
flashlight.
Well, it would if we've gotten really weird in the future and everybody just carries around UV bulbs. That's the only way that I can make this work is for whatever reason, because we know that most light bulbs actually do produce some form of UV radiation, but it's not anywhere near. Yep. But it's not anywhere near close to what we see from direct sunlight. Most LED bulbs also produce some, but they produce way less than your conventional fluorescent bulb or incandescent bulb. So if they've switched to a technology that for whatever reason, they're like, no, we don't just want the light. We want massive amounts of UV radiation to be brought about from our flashlights because fuck you, nature. Yeah, you could walk around with a literal torch attached to you. I just don't know why they would. But
because
maybe
they can.
Yeah,
well,
maybe
I mean, maybe they need it because when they're going off planet, they don't get enough UV radiation and the vitamins that you get thereby. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like a resident of Scandinavia, like Sam, who lives in the dark for a very long time. You need one of those lamps to kind of.
I have friends who have UV lamps in their offices in winter.
Now that is an interesting idea. If you're trapped on a spaceship for years at a time, it might be that you do alter your bulbs to produce some form of UV radiation to basically help to keep people more relaxed or calm. It's a great idea. Now, one of the best ideas I'd stumbled across in the internet that I enjoyed and I wanted to share with you guys is people were proposing that the bioraptors are an external species that basically had been brought by the last group of researchers that had brought these species potentially as a pet with potentially a very limited genetic gene pool that got out of control into the caverns. And ended up growing in population enough up until they were able to attack the researchers. And they potentially are not going to be a long-lived species. They've just been brought in as an invasive organism and dropped off.
I don't hate it.
So, yeah, again, could they do this? Yes, if there's a bottleneck that took place with a limited population and it produced these changes. And could the UV lights burn them? Yeah, if in fact they've got UV alterations that are present on the spaceship.
Say hello to that round mound of pound. And his power slam. Very deadly.
This could be a product of the fact that you have a planet, and it's kind of annoying that we don't ever fully understand what sort of
nighttime.
That we don't ever see what sort of nighttime, daytime regime, like light regime, there is on this planet. Is it just really extended days followed by really extended nights? Like you have night for 2 weeks and then light for 3 weeks? Or is it almost random because you have three different suns that this thing is orbiting? Or I'm not an astronomist by any means. And so I have no idea how this would affect a planet, you know, having three different suns in the vicinity.
I do know that there are binary and I don't know the word for the three, but there are many solar systems out there that have more than one sun.
Yeah.
And from my understanding, a solar system like ours, where there is only one star, is a bit of an exception. The most common solar system has two stars.
Okay. Well, see, this is the thing. Like, I don't know if you would get consistent...
Solar cycles,
yeah. I don't know if you would get consistent solar cycles... Or if they would be somewhat random because of the nature of the fact you have three stars. If they're somewhat random, then you have to have some sort of triggering mechanism to wake an organism up. Because if these things can't go hunting at all, then they're going to have to go into some sort of torpor or hibernation when the sun is up. Because otherwise they just can't sustain themselves. We do see them caching. Do you say caching in America? Or caching?
We say caching.
Yeah, you do see them caching food. You see all those skeletons in the outer regions of the cave. And potentially there's lots of life underground. I mean, in an area
is
where...
Is that caching, though? Or is that just they happen to find... They just ate the body where it fell? Because it seems to be pretty slapshot. There's one here. There's a bit there. There's a skull up there. There's a spinal column over there.
Yeah, but that, I mean, this is, and again, I think this is the outer reaches of this cave system. So I think they've probably got more food further in.
And they would have had to drag them down because most of the human bodies they found would have been from the camp, meaning they would have had to drag them down into the nest.
Yeah. I think, well, Yeah, this is the thing. If they are cashing, then I think it's potentially further down, but they might not be, because you don't need to if you have more consistent solar cycles, right?
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, because then you can potentially stock up on what you need to be eating. At the start of winter in Norway, you do see great tits, bullfinches, blue tits. They get a bit chonky. But, I mean, they're tiny birds, right? They don't weigh much to start off with. I cannot imagine bioraptors putting on the chonk, you know, and still being able to fly around.
No, they're not going to win the world's fattest bear competition for the season as they go back to their cave to hibernate. Yeah. They want to make it into the cave in the first place.
Yeah. I would have loved to see just a shot of one of these things flying into the cave and then just smashing both, like, the ends of their, like, face plates on the side of the hole.
Ow. I do also, love the
what is with the weird active camouflage they seem to have that no one ever touches on, because the first scenes where we see them, they're
they crawl out of the wall.
All you see is the outline of the organism that moves, because its skin is changing colors with the background of the cave, and you see that also in the core sampling room.
Oh, okay. I didn't see that. I thought it was were moving around very slowly that you can't really tell they're there and in the shadows and that sort of shit.
It's just the outline.
Maybe makes sense that they're different species then.
Yeah. But in any case, they're going to need to cache prey in some way if things are really unreliable in terms of the solar cycle, because they're going to need food, because they don't know how long they're going to be in there for. Whereas they've got a reliable solar cycle, they can potentially eat up it might only be a week. These things might be capable of going a week or 2 weeks without food. We know plenty of species are.
There are species that are capable of doing it, but I highly doubt that these are the ones. Because you think about species that go through torpor or brumation or hibernation, what have you. And while they can have some very quick bursts of activity, like an alligator can and will chase you down on ground if you're close enough, they're not a very active and fast-moving organism in general. And these things are nothing but speed. They never move slowly.
And sustained flight as well. Like, some of them are flying, I'm assuming, quite large distances. So, I don't think... I think caching is their only option. Unless there's, an extensive cave system underground and there's plenty of food down there.
Which there has to be. Like, if it's been the periods that they think of time that's taking part, I think that if we actually went underground in this area, you would find big, extensive, open caves that would explain this limited flight from spot to spot, as well as other more varied life forms. That we just have a situation where a species that is normally allergic to light and has gotten established in that area experiences a bit of dark and is like, oh, fuck, I'm going to go out here and eat whatever I can.
Explains the bioluminescence of those worms.
I was just about to say, I feel like this makes narrative sense with the bioluminescent worms, because they may have developed that as a defense mechanism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, and Libby brought up this really good point when we were watching the movie, it's just the classic Prometheus alien covenant situation of, ooh, something I don't know what it is. Let's reach out and touch it.
Oh,
usually in nature, if something is very bright, especially if it's in glowy and it looks like it, like, hey, maybe don't touch me. You shouldn't touch it because it's probably toxic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now we find ourselves referencing back to Adam, high school, fighting off the bullies by covering himself in a tub of glitter, coming to school and just standing there and going, don't touch me!
I'm dangerous.
As if I could get anyone to pay attention to me in high school.
Oh, man.
It's fine.
Don't worry, I was a loser as well.
Now, the last subject I wanted to touch on is just their vision. And we get to see this a couple of times in the film, that kind of like broken up, grayed, just seeing like the pieces, very much implied that they rely on echolocation with the like don't
2000s
move.
Clip art effect.
Yeah.
This is more like the late 90s, early 2000s, trying to go to the Cinemax channel when you didn't have it. And occasionally you might see the outline of a body through that stem on a channel that you don't actually have.
Yeah.
That'll date us and show the listeners what generation we come from.
Mm-hmm.
You all know what a floppy disk is?
This echolocation does kind of fit with like the clicking noise that these creatures are able to produce when they seem to be in flight, as well as like people who are crunching or making noise, like where Vin Diesel completely abandons that small kid to be eaten, where he just like pulls himself back into the shadows and lets it like go after and eat the... Yeah, that's also a dark moment that we don't think about.
I mean, he told the kid not to run and to stay fucking still, and the kid didn't listen, and guess who got?
It's a kid.
Fucked around and found out, Dave.
Who watched him do the same thing with British lady, and she didn't listen, and she got got.
Yeah.
Australian lady, Adam. Her name's fucking Shazza.
Shazza.
I love that there was a woman called Sharon in this, and they're like, we're not fucking around for the US audiences. We're calling her Shazza straight up.
Shazza.
Now, the two biggest...
I apologize to Shazza.
Shazza.
The two biggest problems we're running into with just the way that they structure their echolocation in this is, one, the blind spot is huge. The one that Vin Diesel is able to hide an entire version of himself in its blind spot and just move
both
around
biceps.
And, like, stay. Like...
I mean, it's a cool scene, but how does he come to that conclusion? I mean, he thinks they're using echolocation, right? The sound isn't coming from the fucking, like, edges of the hammerhead. It's coming from their mouth, right? And he's right in front of the mouth? What the fuck?
That scene made no sense to me. He's just, like, holding the head. He just goes, oh, they've got a blind spot. Where did you get this from? How did you decide this? Why does this happen?
Right.
Also, you're not moving your feet. So as he's moving his body, but his feet are still in the opposite end. Like, so he could still be seen. Right.
Echolocation doesn't depend on the ability of the organism making sound. All right. The hunting organism is generating sound, but it's not like a bat flying for an insect is like, oh, well, the insect wasn't making any noise, so I couldn't eat it. That's not how anything works. And so Vin Diesel being like, we all need to be quiet or we need to, like, stay in these areas. No, it'll still fucking find you. It'll still eat you. Now,
I feel like this comes off the whole, like, dumb Jurassic Park, if you don't move, it can't see you sort of thing.
Yes, humans thinking that we could totally survive every predator and organism by just being smarter and tougher and keeping our emotions. Pulling a, what was Will Smith's terrible movie?
Which one?
Yeah, which one?
Independence Day?
After Earth.
Oh, After Earth.
I would say Independence Day is his best movie, so.
His best? Really?
I sent you guys an image. Did you look at it for dolphins and echolocation?
Yes.
It's cool. So we've actually started doing some research with echolocating species to try and generate our closest approximation of what we think their vision is. And I will probably pop this into the SoundCloud as well, because I just think that's the creepiest fucking image. And it's not even a complete... It's a 2D image. They think most likely the way that these echolocating organisms are processing this information is by actually creating images that they can see in 3D. So they've done 3D modeling to try and give them an idea as to kind of what this would look like.
Yeah, for anybody who wants to know, it's kind of a cross between what these creatures actually see in the show and the movie poster for 1984's The Thing.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, more interestingly, because I thought this was really cool, and I thought you guys would appreciate this, bats. So what came first, bats' ability to fly and see or their ability to echolocate?
I mean, obviously, I would think that they would develop
eyes first.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's the idea of the flight versus echolocation is the one that's been bugging scientists for a while. Like, did they learn to fly and then echolocate, or did they learn to echolocate and then fly?
Fly and then echolocate.
I would think they learn to fly and then echolocate, yeah.
Yeah! So, 2008 paper, they had come out that was examining a 53-million-year-old skeleton that had been identified, which has potentially solved the question of flight or echolocation, which came first. So, as reported in Nature, they ended up finding these fossils. There were multiple of them, each measuring less than 4 inches long, and representing the oldest, most primitive bat species yet identified. These creatures had wings, much like modern bats. However, when looking at them, what they found was that the animal's cochlea, the part of the inner ear that detects air vibrations, is too small to be used to navigate by listening, suggesting that they learned to fly before they learned to echolocate. Also missing are two pieces of bony features that mark echolocating bats, a large protuberance off of the middle ear bone, and a flared tip at the end of a long skinny bone in the back of their skull. So the reason they think that they developed echolocation, which I was like, this will make both Adam and Sam very happy. So The current theory speculates that the first bats were active in the daytime, using their eyes to get their bearings in the air and to hunt insect prey, but were driven into nocturnal activity by feathered predators that emerged after the dinosaurs died out 65 million years ago. Which is just really cool. I love the idea of, like, you've got this flying species running around, and then this other group starts predating them, and the answer is, fuck you, I live in the dark now, all right? I'm just going to move to a completely, it is the David equivalent to, I'm being picked on in a certain lunchtime, and I'm like, well, fuck you, I'm going to move to the other lunchtime. What are you going to do about that?
You adopted the shadows, whereas I was born on them. My favorite bit of trivia when it comes to bats is the fact that we always used to think, because there was that bit of that common knowledge fact about bats that they never collided in their caves, even though they couldn't see. And then we developed like night vision camera traps, and we found out they bump into each other all the
all the time.
David Attenborough has this story where he was standing on a massive pile of guano, batshit. And he was telling the story to the camera about the fact that bats would never collide with him because they could echolocate. And then the camera switched off and one flew straight into his face.
Nice. Now, the reason I bring all this up as well, the skull is completely misdesigned. If their hope was that they were creating a skull that would potentially better catch sound with those long protuberances off the side of it, no. They're not shaped in any scoop mechanism or any concentrating mechanism. There's no way that they could be using those. I understand maybe having a solid aspect of bone attached to your face so that if you're chewing on something, maybe you're hunting something very aggressive that scratches, and not having any eyes, just having a pair of teeth allows you to chomp into these things without suffering a lot of damage. But then you need to have a better mechanism for catching noise.
Yeah, they're not the best designed creature.
They look cool, though.
This is the thing with these guys, though. I don't think anything is too much of a stretch. It's just, as Adam was saying, the combination of everything is just, it tips them over the edge.
The combination and the exaggeration.
Head shark!
All right, for story this week, I wanted to talk about what is an antihero. I know Sam said that you were confused about what an antihero is.
I mean, I thought I knew what an antihero was, but then, like, everything's a fucking antihero these days.
Yeah, so I think this confusion is great because antihero has such a wide spectrum of what it could be. That it is really confusing. I mean, it's in the name, anti-hero. They're a character that falls outside the lines of traditional heroic characteristics. So these can range from making morally right choices, courageousness, idealism, or optimism. So it doesn't have to be like a one-size-shoe-fits-all type thing. It can be a lot of different things that make it an anti-hero. They usually tend to make self-focused choices or act in ways that defy most ethical standards. And mostly they're like outcasts to society. So some by choice, some not. But generally, antiheroes suffer from ennui, apathy, anxiousness, or pessimism. So yeah, it is kind of a broad category, to be honest. Like, it's not something where you can have a set standard of characteristics like a hero, right? You think, oh, they're brave, you know, virtuous and true. The antihero can be anything from the shut-in in the mom's basement who's scared of society to, you know.
Adam's really taking a beating this episode. I would just like to throw this out of here.
I'm not scared.
Okay, well, can I list off some, and Libby, you say whether or not you think they classify as an anti-hero?
Yeah, I've got a list of popular ones, so I'd be interested to see if you list some of them.
Robert De Niro in Taxi Driver.
Yes.
Tyler Durden in Fight Club.
I am not comfortable answering that because I've only seen Fight Club once.
Okay. Rorschach in the movie.
Ooh.
I would say Rorschach is definitely an anti-hero.
Okay.
I think so.
Leonardo DiCaprio's character in The Wolf of Wall Street.
Asshole.
So technically, yes.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. So another kind of going along with that, like other popular anti-heroes include Batman, obviously, Clint Eastwood's Man with No Name in the Dollars trilogy, John Rambo, Tony Soprano, Walter White, Mad Max, Michael Corleone. So all these characters that range from just bravado to badass to straight fucking, you know, evil.
What about the new Joker, Incel Jesus?
He would not be. And so I'm kind of going to get into that. So there, just to kind of wrap up the anti-hero stuff, and then I'm going to move on to two other things, which might help explain anti-heroes a little bit better. So the anti-hero did emerge as a foil for the traditional hero archetype. Sort of the fictional balance. Some of my personal favorites in literature is The Stranger by Albert Camus, and Franz Kafka's The Metamorphosis. So the anti-hero is a category, but then you have two other categories which kind of blend together. One is called a false protagonist or a decoy protagonist. Yeah, so this is a technique which intentionally fools the audience into believing the character is a hero, but is in fact not. This can be sort of like a red herring dupe situation. So that example being Miriam Crane and Psycho. So the first whole 30 minutes is about her, right, in the movie. It's about her, like, stealing this money and running away. But then she just gets, like, ganked in the shower, and you find out that she's not the protagonist at all.
Sorry, what was that? What was that verb? Ganked?
Ganked.
Ganked.
G-A-N-K?
Yeah.
Are you fucking with me, or is this a real word?
No, it's not
a real word.
Really? Look, ganked. Sorry, keep going. as you were.
So that's an example of, like, sort of the decoy protagonist, but also a false protagonist would be Don Corleone, right? Like, you have Michael Corleone as the antihero, and Don Corleone, who the movie is named after him, like, it is the Godfather, but he's a false protagonist. Like, it's not about him. The other category in which this tends to really blend with the anti-hero is actually the anti-villain, or another name for it is the sympathetic villain. So obviously they're the opposite of an anti-hero, but while the anti-hero often, but not always, fights on the side of good with questionable or selfish motives, the anti-villain is a villain, but in a way that the audience can kind of sympathize with, or can sympathize with, whether it be the villainy is for, like, a noble cause or because they themselves are victims. So the perfect anti-villain to me is, if you think about Gollum in Lord of the Rings, right? So he is absolutely a villain. He's not an anti-hero. Like, he is bad to the bone, but he is sympathetic. Like, you feel bad for him, and it takes you on this journey of, like, oh, like, I know he's a villain, but, like, I don't want him to, like, suffer, or, like, I don't want him to die, or, you know, like, I kind of like him a lot.
Yeah.
It's such a nice half an hour in The Two Towers when you think Gollum's going to turn good, and then...
Right. The Joker would absolutely be an anti-villain, right? Like, Joaquin Phoenix Joker. So he's a sympathetic villain. Like, he is a villain, but you feel fucking bad for him.
Yeah, I guess, yeah.
And so I'm guessing...
He's being beaten down by the system.
More common examples would be, like, Kingpin in the first Daredevil, or Killmonger in Black Panther.
Yeah, so I guess, does that help shed a light on what the differences are?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I'm still probably going to be lost. I'll be asking you whenever you watch something from
the Yeah. I think, like I said before, I think because the anti-hero category is so broad, like, it just means anything that a hero might... the opposite of what a hero is considered to be, but that could be a whole slew of personality traits or characteristics.
Mm.
Yeah. I feel like the first ever instance I've heard that word used was for the character Blade in the Blade movie specifically. Is that accurate? Yeah.
I feel like he's very heroic in those movies.
Yeah.
I think a general rule of thumb is most anti-heroes, much like Riddick, is they tend to make selfish choices rather than right choices. So, like, Riddick, for example, even though he is doing a lot of things that kind of make you think that he is a hero, like, he's forcing the captain to look at her own morality and like what, you know, ethical means to her. He was about to leave them all on the planet because he wanted to survive. You know, so that's an anti-hero. Like, you root for him, but they're gonna, at the end of the day, it's just about them.
Boom! Death.
So, yeah, wrapping up then, do we feel bad for the Bioraptors?
No.
I feel bad because they get a dumb name.
I do feel bad for them. But I feel like, as you quote, unique as these organisms are, I never really got any sense of personality from them. Like, in a lot of ways, I feel like that the xenomorph from Alien could have gone this way as well, just being a weird looking thing that's in a forgettable movie. But for some reason, there's more to those creatures in that movie than there is these creatures in this movie. And I just don't really feel anything for them.
And also, it's not like they suffered. I mean, you lost 10 out of a population of like 1,000.
Yeah, there's a fuck ton of them.
Yeah, they'll be fine. They'll be just fine.
You squash 10 mosquitoes. There's lots. They'll be okay.
No, I do feel bad for, though. Those fucking glowworms just getting ripped off the cave walls and stuffed into big fucking carboys.
Yeah. Same! I felt really bad in that scene. Yeah. Horrible. Yeah, I don't feel bad for the monsters, but I also kind of don't feel bad for the people either.
The kids getting torn apart. I mean, the one kid gets torn apart by the little babies in the locked off space. That doesn't feel like that would be great.
Yeah.
And
I thought they were going to use that as some big test of faith for Keith David's character, but and like they almost did, but nah, not really.
Then he didn't care. Then it didn't give a shit.
Riddick does get some good shots in, though, when the rain comes down and puts out the torches and he like grins and turns to him. Where the hell is your god now? And it's like, you're all going to die.
Getting in one last smug atheist parting shot.
Checkmate atheists. Sorry, checkmate Muslims.
There's so many people out there who'd be doing that. Like, the apocalypse happens and just like, I fucking told you God wasn't real.
Yeah, absolutely.
Would we recommend this movie?
Absolutely.
100%.
For sure. It's super fun.
Love this movie.
No, I mean, come on. We're all watching this through a little bit of nostalgia and the novelty of Vin Diesel being likable in a role. Okay, fair enough. There's so many other movies from this time period that I would recommend over this one.
Name five.
Aliens.
That's 1984.
It's still in the same decade at this point.
There's only one!
You can't fucking say name five Alien movies off the top of the head. Okay. Starship Troopers. Aliens.
I'll give you Starship Troopers.
Yeah.
Aliens is too early.
Was Aliens 1984 or 1989?
82 or 84. Because Alien was 79.
I got one for you.
Yeah, what's that?
Mars Attack.
Mars Attacks, yeah, 100%. Hang on. Alien Movies 2000.
Oh, here we go.
Well, you can't put me on the spot and expect me to come up with fucking five Alien movies. Okay. Men in Black. That's not the same aesthetic at all.
Nope.
I'll come up with a list, which I will read off at the start of next week's episode. Jesus Christ. Man, the 2000s had some really 2000s movies in it, didn't it?
Yep.
Yes, it did.
That's why this one is worth watching.
Yeah.
Boom.
What are we doing next week?
Next week, we're going to be touching on at least the first, if not the first two episodes of The Book of Boba Fett. So, crank into that Disney Plus subscription, however you may go about doing that. Wink emoji. And just remember, the monsters aren't real, but the science is, and Pitch Black is the best alien monster movie of the early 2000s.
And Hand Shark!
Hand Shark!
Bye.
All you people are so scared of me. But it ain't me you gotta worry about now.
Whatever it is, it got Zeke and it nearly got me! Get it off me!
They seem to stick to darkness. So if we stick to daylight, we should be all right.
A total eclipse. we're gonna lose everybody out here.
You're not afraid of the dark, are you?